Of course, 6 minutes past 12 o'clock, and on the phone at the moment we have Gary Morecambe. Good morning to you, or good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Yeah, not bad, thanks.
Good, glad to hear it. Right then, Gary Morecambe, famous author, and also as well, famous son. We can't forget that with a name like Morecambe. It obviously precedes you everywhere you go, doesn't it?
And it does, but, you know, I really like that. That's, you know, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't be involved in it.
Absolutely. You know, you'd have changed your name, wouldn't you, by now?
Well, yeah, I suppose in life you get these choices that come along, and for me it's always been there, and, you know, since about the age of five, in a way, I sort of seem to have absorbed it all, and Morecambe and Wiser have always been big in my life and no bigger than they are now.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I'll tell you, we'll go into that in a bit anyway, because, as I said, you've got a brand new book come out. It's called Dancing with Angels. It's a very striking cover as well. It's actually available through Apex Publishing, available through good retailers. It's a collection of short stories. What actually got you into starting your writing career?
Well, from the age of 14, I always wanted to write, basically. And I've never really had a specific interest in what I'm writing. It's kind of fairly varied. So I've ended up doing children's fiction, short stories that we're talking about now, and a lot of non-fiction. And then there was getting involved with the play which I wrote with Kenneth Branagh when we did the Morecambe and Wise play. And slightly getting involved in film work now. I just do anything that's kind of challenges me creatively and involves writing. So it's like I say, from a young age, and it's just followed through in all directions.
Yeah, well, I've had a read. I had a read through some of the short stories, and it's very, very good. I mean,
I did a first volume about 10 years ago, and they were very much based on places I've been to all around the world. And I wanted with this one to concentrate more on the human side of things, the human fallibilities, and how we make decisions in life, and everything that therefore follows afterwards is based on a decision. And for the benefit of my short stories, I try to make it quite dark, so that every decision make is fairly dire.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, you go from places like North Africa through to Flanders and places like that. You go to Scotland as well in this, and it's just all stories. Well, not you personally, but stories based in all these different places all over the world. And some of them are quite, how shall I put it, morbid, aren't they?
Yes. I think if I have one thing about being Eric's son, I think that it's to do the contrast of what he was about and go more on the introverted, macabre side, really. I don't think it's coincidental. I've never worked on any comedy in my life.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things. I mean, obviously, you know, the song Tears of a Clown and things like this, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but also it's quite true. I mean, as I said, we're talking a bit anyway about your dad, but yeah. You know, as we said, you know, some of the stories in here, you know, there's some real sort of not unenjoyable, but very morose and very, as you said as well, it's exploring the humanity as well.
Yes, I think they're very introspective. I think a lot of it is people looking inside themselves and life not working out for them and how they deal with it or how external circumstances make them have to deal with it. It's dealing with real issues, I hope. I mean, that was the basis of it. And then obviously because they're a short story, it's tarting them up a bit so that they have a little bit of a twist in the tale as well to make people think, oh, you know, that was a surprise.
Are there any of the actual stories that you feel quite precious of or would like to actually expand on them as well?
Yeah, I think that the two stories in there that I was really excited about, the first one that got me into writing that particular collection of short stories was a Second World War one about the French Resistance.
Yeah.
I thought that the location was great, and I thought that all the characters were great, and I thought the fact that it became almost a bit of a whodunit type feel to it, even though it's a war story, that really pleased me. I thought that, and then it still had another big twist in the tale at the end. So I was very pleased with that, and I was very pleased with the title story, because although it's a somewhat surreal glimpse of Eric and Ernie, and it's a very short story.
Yeah.
I thought the fact it was so surreal, I also thought that, dare I say, I thought I wrote it rather well. And it was well.
And you did, you did.
So that pleased me. I think those two were the main ones.
Yeah. Well, some of the work actually, it reminds me, because one of my, my favourite author, I don't know if you've ever heard of him at all, William Boyd.
Yes, I love William Boyd.
Yeah, Ice Cream War.
That's one of my favourite books.
That's one of my favourite books as well.
Yeah, I loved it. And that was probably a subconscious, you know, effect on me there, I think, because I love his style of writing. I thought that was a great book.
Yeah, see, I was getting that sort of descriptiveness as well, and it was, what was the one? The one where it starts off about, like, the ants walking along the twig and things like this, and I was sort of...
And it
sort of, like, puts you, catapults you straight into that part there, and, I'm really impressed that you like William Boyd as well, because he's, as I said, one of my favourite authors, Brazzaville Beach.
Oh, definitely, yeah, been a big influence, and I think also with the device of the short story is that you do have to transport the reader there extremely quickly.
Yeah, you...
otherwise it just ain't a short story.
You're slap bang, you can't establish characters, you need to know what you're getting from the first point.
That's right, they've got to give off signals so that you recognise those characters really quickly, throw them into the location, and then let the story, you know, the narrative just shoot through and get you out the other side pretty quick, and hopefully leaving you a little bit like, well, that was good, but, oh, I wish I'd known more about this and more about that. Not all the strings should be tied at the end with a short story.
Yeah, the you saying, though, about the William Boyd, I mean, one of the actual things that when I read one of his books was The New Confessions. I don't know if you've read that at all.
I haven't, no.
The first line of that book, it's like a big smack in the face to you, because the first line of the book, and it will stay with me for the rest of my life, it says, it's all about this guy who's he gets involved with film and things like this, and the first line of the book is, "My first act on entering this world was to kill my mother." And his mum died in childbirth. But you read that and you're like, whoa, and there's no emotional attachment there. I mean, you could write essays just on that one line. In fact, I did when I was doing A-level. And, you know, that was just, you know, that there, slam, you're in there.
That's
and
wonderful.
You're...
I mean, that straight away you're in that book, aren't you?
And that's the thing. And that's why I was saying, you know, when, like, as I said there, when that there with the twigs and, you know, you can see the ants walking up. And I was like, whoa, you know, you just feel absorbed into it. I mean,
yes.
Are you actually thinking of expanding any of these stories in the book, or have you got anything else in the pipeline yet?
Not really. I mean, I have to say I'm getting straight back here onto Eric here, but I'm doing a very big book on my father for next year because it's the 25th anniversary since he died.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a lot on next year.
Was it really that long ago? I think.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
I think it's where we, where we're treated, and I mean... you're very lucky as well in the respect that, you know, people who lose parents and things like this, they don't have as many memories on film as obviously you have. And I mean, I've read all the books. I mean, Eric Morecambe is, without a doubt, one of my biggest heroes. There's him, Tommy Cooper. There's not many other people.
No, I agree. I'm on your side.
I mean, I don't know. Did you get the email this morning I sent you?
I didn't.
Oh, I've sent you an email this morning, and it's actually my little boy. He's 7 years old,
yeah.
And I bring him up on a lot of the stuff that I was brought up on.
Yeah.
And so
I did get your email. Sorry, I've corrected myself. It was standing by the statue of Eric.
Yes, that's
it. They were great.
Yeah,
I answered your email.
Oh, because at work, see, I can't get my personal emails up on there. But we actually went off to Morecambe to go and actually see the statue, and he was loving it. He really was.
Brilliant. I mean, he looked like he was having great fun.
Oh, he really was. And I mean, he's... that there as well, great honour. But as I said, the fact that, you know, you've got all these lovely memories, and, you know, that's why probably now, when I'm thinking of it, crikey, 25 years ago... Well,
25 years coming up to, isn't it? Next year is the anniversary year, so there'll be a lot of radio and TV and books and the like. Yeah, there's going to be a lot happening next year.
Well, we'll have to speak to you again about that. I mean,
that'd be good. I'm all for that.
Yeah, I mean, he's, as I said, he's great, and I mean the fact as well, as I said, I'm trying to still get hold of a copy of the book, Mr. Lonely, your dad wrote.
Yeah, that's not easy to get hold of. I mean, I've had trouble with that because I've been trying to get a TV production up of that. I'm working at the moment on that. And just trying to get copies of it, it's really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there was a signed one on eBay.
Yeah.
And that was about a year ago. And the bidding went frantic on it. I mean, it went up for over, like, $3.50, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I was just like, whoa, you know, I was clicking on the last minute. I even set my phone, so my alarm came on. And I was like, right, I'm going to not get outbid on this. And in the end, I did, and it just went, it sort of skyrocketed.
Yeah.
And it's one of those crazy things. I mean, big question as well is, what was it like having probably the most famous dad in the UK when you were growing up?
Yeah, it was. Well, you know, it sounds a glib answer to say it, but it's absolutely the truth. And I had this conversation with Michael Sellers, the son of Peter Sellers, and we both said that the thing is, you don't know any different.
Yeah.
It's very hard to compare, to say, well, it could have been like this or like that. I mean, it was interesting, and... in the sense that that's what he did, and his work was television, and off he went to do his work. But, you know, I was brought up in a very kind of like basic or sensible way by my mother, who's still with us and very grounded person.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. She kept you sort of like, you know, it's not all about the celeb parties and things like that, is it?
It was completely not about that. So we had a very detached from show business, detached upbringing that was just basically go to school, you know, school holidays. Okay, school holidays are a bit different because we'd go off to summer season or whatever where Eric and Ernie were performing. But even that was just a holiday. It wasn't really like you were part of some other glamorous world. And for me, it didn't really become more into that until I was in my late 20s, which was when I went to work for my father's agent. I did 3 years doing that, working in press and publicity. And that was when, for me, it became exciting. You know, not the childhood bit. That was just my dad going off to do a job.
I mean, I remember you saying, actually, I can't think if it was in a book or on a TV show, but you actually said that sometimes your dad could sort of get embarrassing because you had friends over. And he'd be sent to stage and he'd be acting the fool and things like this.
Yes, I think there's a kind of something irrepressible there about him, and very sort of in touch with the child within himself. And yeah, it used to be quite irritating for me. but I have to say, all my friends thought it was fantastic, as they would, of course.
I'm sure they would, you know.
When I look back, it's always with a smile on all of that. You know, I don't look back with any kind of problem. So I'm sure it was just me being a teenager that couldn't cope. And now I look back, now I'm in my 50s, and it all seems... It always seems so recent, actually, is one thing, and just so sad that it's not still here, because I really enjoyed all of that.
I mean, as I said as well, you've got all the lovely memories, though, as well. You've got the, you know, the beauty of, you know, modern technology now. You know, you can click on YouTube, for instance. You know, you can click on you can click on a DVD and things like this and watch, you know, a majority of his work and things like this. And, I mean, it's...
That's true, and I do that. It's great. You
know, yeah.
It's really enjoyable to be able to do that, and it is... You do feel very privileged that you can do that because, as you said earlier, not many people who lose a parent can get to reconnected with them so easily.
Yeah, and I'm sure you can even... I mean, I can imagine because I've heard all and read the books as well, as I said, about his study and how he literally make himself ill, especially worrying about the Christmas specials. I mean, that was the big thing with him, wasn't it, towards sort of the end, the latter part of his career. It was getting these Christmas specials. I mean, the amount of weight he used to have on his shoulders, wasn't it?
Yes, it's self-perpetuating because he was doing them, and then they were successful, so therefore he had to do a better one the following year, or so they felt. And it ended up when they were starting to write stuff and even rehearse some of the stuff, like in June for Christmas. And that just, and bear in mind, they were also doing TV series at the time as well, six episodes, you know, in the series. So, yeah, it was quite stressful, actually. I'm now putting it mildly, it was very stressful, because I do also think that as the comedian of the pair, as the main comedian at least, and the renowned funny man, I think he did shoulder a lot of it. I think, I mean, Ernie was brilliant at what he did, but Ernie had this wonderful knack of turning up and doing his work and then going home. He could switch off. He just was really good at that.
Yeah.
But Eric wasn't like that. He did sort of take it home with him, and it was permanent, you know, for all those months until it was in the can.
Yeah.
So he was living and breathing it, which was probably not a healthy thing to do, looking back.
No, but in the same breath, though, as well, he gave so much enjoyment for everybody in the UK.
Wonderful.
I mean,
yeah, so
after the 27, and it's still the record, isn't it, for a comedy or TV show in general?
I think it is, just for a Christmas
27 million in 1977, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah, that's about it, 27, 28 million, that's right, it was, yeah, for a 1977 Christmas show.
And
yeah, phenomenal. I mean, you wouldn't get that kind of viewing now anyway, because television's fragmented.
Yeah,
But even so, yeah, it's a phenomenal amount of viewers.
You know, when you think of that, you know, and as I said, you know, it's fair play. He made us laugh constantly, you know, every now and then, you know, you still pick up the old wine bottle or things like this and just lift it up with your arm next to it and things like that. And you get hold of and nobody could do the paper bag trick like your dad could.
No, that was wonderful. It still makes me feel about, like, I watched that on YouTube or something. It's great. I love that.
I mean, my little boy as well, he had this thing where... I can't remember which one it was. I think it was one of the Christmas special box set DVDs that we've got at home. And it's the, it's where Des O'Connor, where he's like, these are all the lists of all the insults for Des O'Connor. He laughs at that. And then when he does the H-A-R-D, hard.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one of my little boy's favourite bits. And he even did that to the statue. So apologies for him slapping your dad's statue in the face. But he actually did go H-A-R-D, hard. And it was just so funny. But also, before you go, because I understand you know, you're very busy and you're jetting off somewhere tomorrow, aren't you?
I am. I'm off on my usual winter sojourn. I always go away for November, so otherwise I get serious depression. Come on. Being in England for the winter.
Thank you for that, yes.
Yeah, sorry about that, but I have to have my shot of sun, otherwise I go crazy.
But
I will be working over there. I take lots of stuff to write.
Well, I just wanted to clear up one story, okay? And I want to find out if it's true or not, okay? There was a... I can't remember where I heard it from, but apparently there was a tie. I think it was your mum, Joan, actually said that she once caught him in the study with the legendary pipe in mouth, and he was listening to a Des O'Connor record. Is that true?
That's actually true.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
But what she didn't add, though, is he had another Des O'Connor album next to it, which I picked up, and in fact, I've even got it here, and it has no hole in the centre of the record, so you can't play it.
Hey!
Which I thought was a lovely kind of contrast.
I love that rivalry. And do you know what? I've actually been looking as well on the system for a Des O'Connor record. And I'm so sorry, Des. We haven't got any on the system.
Oh, no.
I was going to play Dick a Dumb Dumb or something.
Well, he was a very good sport about it all. Because it carried a lot of laughs nationally, that one.
Well, he still owes a lot of his success, doesn't he, to the fact of the amount of Mickey taking there was. And it kept his name in the, you know,
absolutely.
In the public eye.
I think there was a slightly more serious side. I think his kids suffered a bit at school from it all, which was a bit... we didn't find that out until it was on a documentary, actually, a few years ago. And I think that was sad, because if Eric and Ernie had known that, there's no way they would have carried on doing it, because, you know, they weren't like that.
It was never cruel, was it?
Yeah, so it was a bit unfortunate, because they just thought it literally would began and ended with Des, and that they had helped his career, which they did, and Des admits that. But it's a shame when, like, the kids get affected like that. I was very sorry to hear that, and so was my mother, she mentioned it.
Oh, that is a real shame, but again, though, I mean, you know, there's...
Well, again, like you said earlier, it's sometimes you pay a price, and it's entertaining millions of people, and you've got to decide which goes first, don't you, really?
Yeah, well, then again, those bits there, though, you know, with the, With the bit where they're walking down the stairs as well, and, you know, Des just disappears and things like that. I mean, you know, great. I mean, you know, how your dad ever thought of these things up is...
I know, he was a bit... He did sort of sit down and write lots of Des jokes sometimes. I remember him sitting here at home doing that, yeah.
Well, one of the things I will still live with me for the rest of my life is just seeing two grown men in bed together with... Yeah. Ernie reading the Financial Times and your dad reading the Dandy.
I know, wonderful, isn't it? It says everything. It's just tremendous, and it's a real throwback to Diggs, because there was nothing kind. There's no innuendo there, and it just goes back to the days when they were in Diggs and they used to have to share a bed together on the road as kids.
Well, it was along the Laurel and Hardy lines as well. You know, they shared
Laurel and Hardy,
a bed.
Yes, similar thing, but it was probably more like that. Back then, you had to do these things.
Well, the amount... I tell you what, I'd hate to have seen your the amount of miles your dad has travelled over the years. I mean, they did the Ed Sullivan thing, didn't they, as well? And, you know, backwards and forwards all over the country.
I know. They kept doing that for years.
Well, yeah. Gary, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. As I said, the link will be on the website as well for your book. And
wonderful.
As we said as well, Dance With Angels by Gary Morecambe. It's available now to buy. Great collection of short stories. Not the humorous thing you might think, and also good luck with the book, and hopefully we'll speak soon in the next year.
Definitely, we'll be out there for the next book.
Yeah, that'll be fantastic. Next time we'll have to try and get you in the studio.
I'm quite happy to do that.
Right then, get yourself up to Northumberland. It's a great part of the world
as
well.
I can do it and tie it in with visiting Morecambe. How about that?
I'll tell you what, that sounds absolutely fantastic to me. Well, we can't finish off this interview without playing your dad's song, can
Lovely.
We? Right, and thank you very much, Mr. Gary Morecambe on Lineheart Radio.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.